Or even this other fellow who had experiences when he was young, where a Sasquatch arm would reach in and get him every night. And he was terrified. Yes. Right? He's terrified. And one day he moved through his terror
and decided to
embrace it in a way. And then he found himself flying in a flying saucer with his brother, who was like catatonic and asleep or sleepwalking or whatever.
Yeah.
And they took this flying saucer for a ride, went over here, down through Portland and up to the mothership. And they entered the mothership and they had his experience and sharing his experience of how he, you know, said, well, we did this and I went this and they showed me this is how I drive the ship. They let me drive the ship. And so a lot of the words, you know, are probably interpretations of what he was experiencing.
Welcome
to another episode
of Driving to the Res.
It's your favorite hosts,
Inelia
and Larry.
And Larry.
With Theodora
and our cats and Phoebe, our little dog, and Romeo, our bigger dog. Not big, but pretty big, you know? So, yeah. What else do you want to say before we go on? We're going to talk about the mystic fractured mind and identity.
The mystic's fractured mind and identity. I mean, that's a real catchy title, I gotta say.
You think so? I wondered about that.
I wonder if it catches the meaning. So I think that it's one of those ones that when you say it, you are defining yourself some way, right? So I think we could say the fractured mind or symptoms of a fractured mind, maybe. Might be more encompassing.
I don't know if I want to be encompassing of everybody on the planet, if that's what you're saying, because I'm not interested in everybody on the planet.
Just the mystics?
Yes.
Okay.
Am I interested in awakened individuals who by default are mystics? That's what I'm interested in, so.
Okay, so if you are a mystic, the chances are you have something of a fractured mind.
Yeah, with all the mystics I've worked with,
that's all of them.
That's been in all of them. Everybody has had a certain levels of this fracturing of the mind and identity. So that's why I thought I'd address it.
Okay. I thought I would mention this topic came up a little bit in our subscribe stars.
Our second hour sponsor, right? No, it wasn't a second hour sponsor. It was a platinum sponsor.
Well, that's a second hour sponsor in a way.
No, they get the second hour, but they also get the classes in focus. They get a study group. They get weekly discussions about the podcast and the second hour. They also get homework every week, and they also get a reading, a card reading.
Yes.
Every month, once a month.
Once a month, get it.
And at the moment, we have one sponsor that's Platinum and has been sponsoring card readings for the Subscribe Star every month for the past few months. And this topic did definitely come up in their reading this month. So
I thought it was appropriate to talk about wider because I've noticed it becoming more and more obvious that people are beginning to unfracture a little bit, right? Unfracture in the sense that they're becoming more who they are, even if they had in the past maybe identified themselves as basically something else. Like I can think of one fellow I was listening this morning.
I was going to ask you about that.
He was a tribal fisheries biologist, scientist, something like that. He worked for the four tribes in Musbin and closer to Seattle. I think there's four tribes that are like one confederation of tribes. I can't remember exactly which four tribes they are. At any rate, he was, he had spent the last 20 plus years or so working at the tribe, and he had experiences that were well outside, I guess, what you would call normal. Even his Bigfoot experiences were outside of normal Bigfoot experiences, right? It's like,
yes.
Okay, I can talk about Bigfoot, but I can't talk about the weird stuff.
Right.
Yeah. That's not weird, you know?
We also saw that quite a lot in the two Bigfoot events we've been to.
It's true. It's true, yeah. Right?
There's the Bigfoot crowd, and then there's the woo-woo Bigfoot crowd that stay by themselves, and
they're a little too strange
for the Bigfoot. Everybody makes fun of them and stuff like that. Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, it's kind of funny. Anyway, he's moved past the point where he's concerned with what other people think about how weird it is that whatever he says that his experiences are, or his thoughts are. It's just like, hey, in his mind, he got permission to say whatever he wants to.
Yeah.
And in the past, he was restricted from it.
Right.
So with this permission, you know, he just letting the bombs fall as they go.
No, that doesn't necessarily mean that the person, what they have to say is valuable or accurate or anything.
Totally.
It's just about the perception and the perception of the person about what they can talk about right now, right?
Right. What they self-censor in some ways.
Yeah, self-censor, but also self-identify.
And self-identify.
Yeah, right. And also identifying their friends and their audience, you know?
Yeah, I can really like say for a long time I identified myself as a fisherman. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we have friends who identify themselves as Leos.
Yes.
Leos are law enforcement officers, by the way. And sometimes they'll take the identity on and that will be who they are. Who are you is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Marine
or whatever's these identities that we pack on. And those ones are separate from, I think, in some ways, not many of us, besides maybe in the crowds, you know, we run in now, not many of us identify ourselves. Oh, who are you? Well, I'm a mystic, right?
Right.
Or a light, what do we call that? Brilliance of light worker? Light worker.
A brilliance of light.
Light worker turner on her. So, a light switch flipper or whatever, you know what I'm talking about. Right? Yes. It's like one thing or another thing or another thing. But it's not like a mystic fisherman.
Yeah.
Or a mystic tribal biologist, whatever, right?
Right. Right.
Or even this other fellow who had experiences when he was young, where a Sasquatch arm would reach in and get him every night. And he was terrified, right? He's terrified. And one day he moved through his terror
and decided to
embrace it in a way. And then he found himself flying in a flying saucer with his brother, who was like catatonic and asleep or sleepwalking or whatever.
Yeah.
And they took this flying saucer for a ride, went over here, down through Portland and up to the mothership. And they entered the mothership and they had he had his experience and sharing his experience of how he, you know, said, well, we did this and I went this and they showed me this is how I drive the ship. They let me drive the ship. And so a lot of the words, you know, are probably interpretations of what he was experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to how when the tribe here, when we have our, I can't even call it ship experience. We'll just call it ship experience, where we all go up to the ship. And you came along one time to see where the hell are you guys going?
Yes. Yeah. I said, well, you could call it a ship, I suppose.
You could call it a ship, right? What article was that? That you wrote that describes a space...
aliens, I think.
We'll find the link for it if you're curious. It's really fun.
Yeah.
So he shared his experience when he was a kid with his mom at the dinner table with everyone else. And she made a bit of fun of him. And then for the next few years, every family dinner, she'd make a little bit of fun of him about the UFO thing. Yeah. So he said, well, I'm not talking about that anymore. And something like 10 or 20 years later, she fessed up that she had her own experience in a room that terrified him. So, yeah, I had my own abduction experience there. I got taken by aliens there, too. It's like, what? Why were you making fun of me this whole time? So I don't know. But that gave him permission also again. Now he just says it. But
I can see, like, from that dynamic that he told about why she would do it, because she probably had a really rough time of it.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to prevent him from talking.
Oh, protect him a little bit.
Yeah, to protect him.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
But we're at a different time now, and I think that's why we need to...
We are in a different time, and our audience is a different audience.
Yes.
Right? And it is time to integrate ourselves become one.
Become who you are.
Yes,
right?
Become one person rather than I'm a mystic over there and I work on my enlightenment over here and I'm a
day job over here.
And I'm a husband over here and I'm a wife over there and I'm a father here and I'm a son here. You know, it's like, and I'm a whatever bicyclist on the weekends with my mates, you know. It's like you mentioned to me the other day that many people get surprised, you know, when I say things like, you know, I'm a certified network administrator for computer systems or whatever. And it's like, yeah, I got a certificate that states it. I used to have a lot of them. But
I find it more funny that you're insulation installer.
Yes, an insulation installer was my first job coming out of school. Yeah, when I was a teenager. So there's all these things, you know? And it's like it didn't seem important to me to, unless there's a skill needed, right? It didn't seem important to say, yeah, I'm a qualified of that, I have a certificate of that, and I worked that, I have so many years' experience on that. Because to me, it was never separate to what I was always doing. It wasn't a separate thing. I've never stopped being a mystic to become a coder, for example. On the contrary, that's exactly what I use, the same skills. And that's why when I wanted to, let me read some of it.
Yeah, let's read some of it.
Because I do use an example, right? I like stories.
Okay, let's start our podcast.
Okay. The fact that you're reading this means that you are an awakened individual. You can see more than other people can see. Not only that, but you are keen and active in improving your life and the life of our societies. I wanted to qualify the article because this is the individuals that to me are important.
Okay.
These are the individuals that I think can relate to this information and can use it to improve their lives. Many people in our position have gone through life separating our own interests in topics that are considered fringe or too spiritual from our daily jobs and life. We become experts at fracturing our minds and identities. We have the work me, the family me, the woo me, the real me, and many other me. This article should be an essay, really, as this topic is very large. Because the writing format is short, I want to concentrate on one of the ways in which we often fracture our minds and identities as we move through life. We will have expanded discussion around it and share more examples in our podcast, Driving to the Rest, as we're already doing right now, right?
That's the Cindy.
Yeah, yeah. Particularly in the second half with our panel of experts. That's, you know, go to Subscribestar and get the second part. The second part is our podcast is how we thank our sponsors and patrons, and you can find it in the sponsor section of Subscribestar. There's lots of different bits you can do there. Anyways, back to our exploration of mind and identity fracturing. As it is traditional with my people, I will share the ways in which we do this with a story.
I like your story.
Yeah. Do you know what people I'm talking about?
Your people, honey.
Who are my people, honey?
Like your people, the Mapuche.
And what?
And the Spaniards.
Yes. My people come in a lot of places, from a lot of places. The main ones are the Mapuche and the Gypsies from Spain and the Alchemists from Spain, which were a different class of people altogether. And all of them have this tradition of storytelling to impart information. So kind of concentrated on me, I think, in the blood. And I love doing that. So I'm going to tell a few stories. This story is called A Mystic in the Computer Code. Okay. Most people are familiar with what computer code looks like. It appears in movies a lot, and it looks like dozens of numbered lines on a screen. Each line is a command that moves electricity this way and that. It turns things on and it turns things off. For example, when you click a button on your device's screen, it sends you somewhere. That button was created with code, and it listens code that tells it was pressed, then sends you to where it is coded to send you. We're also very familiar with what coders look like, the geek at school, or in movies, the attractive and cool rebellious hacker.
Yeah, right.
The reality is that most gutters are regular people you see in the supermarket buying food for their families. They don't look any differently.
And I'm always shocked when we meet or talk to someone and we're talking for a while. I was like, what do you do? Oh, yeah, I'm
a programmer. I'm a coder, programmer. Like,
you do not look like a coder or programmer.
Not for the ones in the movies anyways. They don't have tattoos or, you know, they don't have large glasses and, you know, skinny.
It's a magnifier glass in there. Many of them can tend to be a little pale, though.
Okay. To be fair, some people do look like that. Yes. For coders. I've never met one myself, but yeah. But pale, yes.
Occasionally.
I've never met somebody who looks like, if you think somebody looks like a surfer, you have an image in your head of this really muscular, tall man with blonde, bleached hair and very dark skin, right? You have this image. To me, surfer, that's what it looks like, right? Or no, you could say a woman. Also, very tall, blonde hair, bleached by the sea, and very dark skin. Yeah. Very muscular. But you, when you think computer coder, that image doesn't come in, does it?
It's not like that, no.
So if you're a coder and look like that, send me a picture. I want to see.
Well, we should invent little add-ons for computer screens that
give you a tan.
Give you the, yeah, tan. Okay,
yeah.
Maybe not.
No. Okay. So. So the gig at school or in the movies, attractive and good rebellious hackers. The reality is that most coders are regular people, like I said before, regularly in the supermarket buying food for their families. They don't look any differently, having been in the coding business for some years, had the opportunity to work directly with coders. On the whole, they were really regular Joes and Janes, but the really good coders, the coders who could find bugs fast or write code that had never been thought of before, these men and women were mystics, and they didn't know it. At least they didn't advertise it or talk about it. These men and women would follow energy lines through the code in the same way I do to find lost keys. They would tap into the collective fields of awareness in the same way a shaman does. With a few of them, I saw that these skills would only come out when they had spent dozens of hours on a piece of code and they were exhausted. Others would do it all the time. The industry called them good coders. I call them mystics. Not surprisingly, these coders were also interested in spiritual advancement, expansion of the mind, ETs, UFOs, and loved fantasy and science fiction. All the things that looked beyond what we might call plain reality. When I have scratched a little bit by asking these mystic coders to explain how they do their work, I usually get two different reactions from them. One is to deny any intuition or mystical skill from the equation and become defensive about their programming training and logical mind skills. The other is to become fascinated by the reality of the mystical skills, or something they would love to learn more about and want to know where or how to learn more. So very different reactions, right?
They're almost like polar opposites in a way.
Yeah.
But I suppose not much to say about it. It's like...
And I'm saying that because a lot of the individuals who are listening to this would have had that reaction in themselves at some point in something in their lives, right? If a mind's called intuitive... I remember growing up, you know, I would see a man that was highly intuitive and says, oh, wow, you're so intuitive. No.
I'm just very observant.
Yes, I'm very observant.
I have a skill at detecting these minor variations.
I can see details.
I can see details. I'm very detail-oriented.
Oriented, yes.
I've trained my mind.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. All right. Whenever I take on a mystical student, the first few months are spent decompartmentalizing their lives. It is spent putting together their minds and identity back together again. Often this involves becoming comfortable with sharing their woo interests with work colleagues and family members. You're still reading this article, which means you have either gone through this decompartmentalization or intuitively know that it is healthy to do so. If it is the latter, the last sentence of the previous paragraph probably made you cringe, i.e. involves becoming comfortable with sharing their woo interests with work colleagues and family members. The thought of your work colleagues and family members knowing that you read this article, for example, may send shivers down your spine. Welcome home. You found your tribe.
That's the funniest thing. There's a lot of funniest things about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's because when you open up to your authentically be yourself, you find that oftentimes you're surrounded by others who are also that and also aren't saying it.
Yes.
And indeed. It's always cracks me up. It's like, yes. I had no idea you were interested in whatever.
Yeah.
And they're like, what? Me, I didn't know you would do either. It's so crazy. How could we possibly have been working together for 10 years and not known the other one is interested in that?
Yes, exactly.
That's how the level of the compartmentalization goes, right?
Yes.
So I have a tiny story about that.
Yay.
It's a fishing one.
Okay.
So I had been identified as a fisherman. Identify as a fisherman. Those are my pronouns.
Your pronouns are fisherman?
Yes.
Can it be fisher person?
No.
No, definitely fisherman.
Yes.
Okay.
That's just my choice. No, my pronouns. Anyway, I was a fisherman, identified as a fisherman. And the way that I learned to fish and to be good at fishing was to copy those who are good at fishing. In other words, mapped them, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I made it, and this is something they talked about, I made it a priority to like look at everyone's boat. How did they make something to do the next thing I needed to do? Like, how do you build a davit, an arm thing that goes out that you tie your block on for your rope to come in? Well, there's nothing on the boat that does that. You have to go make it.
Wow.
And to make it, you have to tell the welder, hey, this is what I want you to build. Mm-hmm. And it's custom for your boat. It needs height, distance, length, swivelabilities. There's all bunch of little details that are required. And you can't go to Walmart and buy, I need a davit for my boat for hauling longline gear. Okay. They don't have them.
They don't have them.
No.
Okay.
So take that times 1,000. There's 1,000 things that need to be like made appropriate for what it is that you're going to do for fishing. And, mm-hmm. and in the past, we learned by our fathers and our fathers' fathers and that kind of thing, there'd be like a generational memory.
Mm-hmm.
You started when you were a kid and you did it. And when you case of where you haven't, you have to like pay really good attention to all of the people who are and copy the ones that seem successful, I guess, you know, just mm-hmm. general speaking, that's how you learn stuff, right?
Yes.
So at some point that is embodying what it is that you're tempting or trying to like be, embody that fisherman,
mm-hmm.
right? And so once you got all the parts and the pieces, then there's crew, you got to find guys to fish. How do you learn that?
How do you learn how to find them? Or
how do you learn how to find the good ones, the right ones? The ones
okay.
Like, that's another thing. So that's a whole nother connection mm-hmm. process. And then you've got all the guys and you got the boat and you got the equipment and it's all lined up and ready to go. Now you got to go, where do I go get fish?
Mm-hmm.
Which seems straightforward. It's like go to the ocean, of course. Do you know how big that place is?
Very big.
Yeah, it's huge. And
then there's specific types of fish, right?
And there's specific types of fish.
Yes.
And then there's specific times of year where the fish are in different places.
Right.
And there's times of the year where they're not there at all. So like, for an example, when I first tried to go halibut fishing, and I say tried.
Tried, okay.
We got all of the guys and all of the hooks and all the bait and all the gear and all the everything.
Things.
And we went out to where you go halibut fishing. We left the dock. We were like, where are we going? I was like, I don't know. Well, how I opened a book it? And it said, halibut live on the continental shelf. They like the edge and blah. There was a book.
Oh, there's a book.
That said where halibut tend to congregate.
Okay.
So I went out to the end of our area. It was like 40 miles offshore. And it started at the top and it looked like there was a flat. And then it was an edge that went down.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came back up and then went flat again. So I said, I'll just go across there, top to bottom and over to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It was like about five miles. And normally when you're set for halibut, we're going like a quarter of a mile or a half of a mile.
Mm-hmm.
I did 5 miles.
Okay.
And the hooks were like, there's one. And then 20 feet later is another one, another one. And this tiny little rope. And I mean, it went from 100 feet down to 10,000 feet and then back up to 100 feet.
Oh my gosh.
That's a slight exaggeration.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you catch any fish?
I did catch fish.
Okay.
But all of the fish that I caught were all of the ones that I wanted were in a quarter of a mile spot, and all the rest of it was like, why even did I put a hook there?
Oh my gosh. Right. Yeah.
So I was very, very, very specific. So I started asking the guys, and they were very close chested, is that the word?
Of course, because it's competition.
They're not telling you nothing.
They're not going to tell you. Yeah.
So I had to go find them on the big ocean.
So where's the fish? Yeah.
You can't even ask them. They won't tell you. So you go hunting. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Where's the fish? That's my hat.
WTF.
My hat.
Yes.
It's WTF. Where's the fish?
Where's the fish?
I'm making a fairly long story out of this, but the point is that 15, 18 years later, mostly trial and error, and very few guys would tell me anything about what to do, how to do, and why, and all of the things. They were just very closed chest about it. Closed heart. So copying them and mapping to them, doing all those things, I managed to generate a reasonably successful fishing. So top five, right? Sometimes the best of everybody, and sometimes not. Just figured out by trial and error over time, right? The fish will be here, and then here, and then here. This is likely, and this is less likely, and this is the kind of bait, all those things. But it never really was
like... What do you mean?
Like, when I began, I'll put it this way. When I did Ascension 101 course, you know what that is?
Yes, it's a course I created in 2010.
You created this course in 2010. And I read one of your books, I think it was called Interview with an Alien.
Yes.
And I went like,
clap.
Dang, that's good. So I looked for some more books and I found you had a few more books. And I saw you had a course called Ascension 101. I was like, I'm doing it. And I bought it and I did it. And I started working on it. And all my life, all I'm doing is fishing. So I'm doing it while I'm fishing, of course.
Of course.
And one day I was in my bunk. I was doing the course and I was, and my eyes closed, and I was kind of like in a meditative.
Altered
state of awareness, definitely. And you came into my space, in my head, and your hand reached down and lifted my chin up, and it opened, and I lifted up my chin, and he said, now you got to open your eyes too. Because I had my head down and my eyes closed. So I opened my eyes like, holy crap. Right? All of a sudden, I could see for a time. Yeah. It was a permanent awakening. Because from that point on, I probably tried to close my eyes with my head down a few times. Mm-hmm. But it just wouldn't stay, Yeah. You know? It stuck like, you have to look, you have to look, you have to look. So I went on a awakening journey. And so I'm still a fisherman and I'm still fishing, but I'm also an awakened journey, and I'm exploring meditations and exploring things like, pituitary gland
cleansing
cleansers and awakeners and activations and all the things you can imagine, but I'm still a fisherman. Right. When the guys are like, I'm going fishing, I'm doing my fishing, and they're playing Snoop Dogg and rap music and Raising Hell, whatever. And I'd eventually moved from partying with them to, are you guys, go do what you're going to do. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm not going to be partying and all the other stuff. It's like, just not into it anymore. Just slowly my life changed, right? And my fishing got a little bit worse. Because I was distracted. Like, my real me wasn't really fishing anymore. My real me was exploring these things,
right,
going
right.
to retreats, topics, going to this, going to that, doing these things. And then at some point they came back together. And so I incorporated my spiritual awakening and practices and understandings and connections with where I am and what I'm doing. I was fishing. So how do I incorporate that? In one case, I used feng shui meditation that connected into my tribe, because the words in the feng shui CD were reminiscent, like very reminiscent of the tribe. I'm a macaw tribe member, and it sounded just like macaw man singing these words in a feng shui. It's about an hour long CD. And I found that when I would connect, I turned on the CD because I was in stress,
right?
Fishing, I really want to like be doing my other work, my spiritual work, but I'm fishing. So let's connect these a little bit. So I turned on my feng shui CD and I started chanting along with it. And I'll be dipped.
You got a lot of fish, didn't you?
There was no fish. And then they all of a sudden schooled together right in front of my net.
Wow.
And
perfect.
I pulled up my net and that sucking net, it was chock block full like you can't believe. Like all the fish we need for an entire trip is right there, one trip, one set. I'm like,
nice.
Wow, that's pretty cool. But that's once.
Okay.
So there was 8 or 10 of us guys fishing like this.
Yeah.
And we all, some of us did good some trips and other trips not so good. But 2 or 3 of us pretty much always do reasonably good, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, from that day forward and for the next 4 or 5 years, I literally became, for all practical purposes, the only one catching those fish. And every time I went, I would turn on the CD, start chanting away at his feng shui, get connected. And as I was saying, the fish would school and tighten up, and then my net would go right through them, and I'd fill up my boat. I mean, we're talking 50,000, 60,000 pounds, which is 2 or 3 semi-trucks full.
Mm-hmm.
And the other boats who were right there doing the same thing in the same place, not doing the chanting and not doing the guy, they were literally not counting anything. Zero. Yeah. Like not even one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the feds investigated you, didn't they?
Yeah, they started to send observer on me every trip because all the other boats were saying, well, he's cheating somehow.
Yeah.
Because why is he the only one catching fish?
Right.
So clearly he's cheating.
Clearly. And you told them what to do.
Well, that was the funniest thing is they asked me after a while, because after a year or two, and even the observer guy that would come on the boat, it's not like he came up and listened to me doing the chanting.
Yeah.
They were there when we dumped the fish out and just check the location and the equipment and the gear we're using and how we set our gear. But while I was fishing, they don't watch.
Right.
But that was the important part, right?
Yes.
That was the spiritual connection part. So I was asked maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years later, one of the fishermen asked me, he said, all right, I know you're cheating. What are you doing? I said, I'm literally doing the exact same thing you are. I have the same everything. The only one thing that's different is I have a CD. It's a feng shui CD, and I sing along with it while I'm fishing. And when I do that, the fish school up, and then I can catch them.
How did that go down?
He started laughing. It's like, that's all. I can't help you then. And it's true. It's true. What do you do? I mean, I can't even say if it would necessarily have worked for him if he did it, but
it worked for you.
It definitely worked for me. And that was the only thing I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, literally everything else is the same. Same day, same time. And even exactly the same place. And we're talking literally, there's one boat, here's another boat. We're like
really close.
Right behind each other by half a minute. No fish, full net, no fish behind me.
Wow.
Very strange. It happened with the salmon too, remember?
Well, the salmon was different.
It was different, but similar. Yes. Because it's not like I disconnected. That was also a connection.
Yes. So the salmon story is really funny. We were doing an event here at the Shaman Shack. It was for Gaia. It was a Gaia event. We had about, I think, 10 people or something like that. And at one point, we received an information that you talked about the... We saw the little baby salmon getting stranded in the creeks and the rivers because there was very little water that year in May. And they're supposed to spawn and they're supposed to go down the streams and the creeks and into the rivers and eventually to the ocean while they're growing.
Right. In a healthy environmental area, there's a bunch of logs and trees and deep, deep pools. So when the water dries up a little bit, the little salmon stay in these deep pools that stay cool and they can survive until the rain comes and then washes them down the river. But in the case of our area, it's been... converted into a farm field. There's no trees, forest, and things like that. So the dry up pools are too small. They dry up and go away.
Yeah.
So the baby salmon needed
that year was really early that this happened, and it's like,
well, it always happens. That's what the pools are for.
Yes, but this year there was like a lot earlier. I remember because
yeah, it was
every
earlier.
Other year they had a few more weeks for them to grow a little bit more and go down the
because they were little babies,
the tiny little babies. So, anyways, at some point during the event, you received the idea, the request from Gaia to save these baby fish.
Just give them a lift down to the river.
Yeah, so put them in tubs and carry them down the river a little bit more where there's more water. And we had like 10...
10 or 20 brides and grooms of Gaia.
So we had a great time. We had a great time.
We filled up these tubs with some creek water, and we had this little butterfly nets. Yes. And we go in there and... collect come on, little guys, and put them all in the little thing. Yes. Get them out of the ponds. Yeah. The little ponds are like big mud puddles, really.
Yeah.
And then collect them all up, bring them down to the river, which was still running. It was just the creek that was all dried up.
Yeah. And so basically saved several thousand baby fish, and in the salmon dynamic, several billion salmons in later generations, right?
Right.
And so that was all great. Fine. It went away. Months went by. And
years,
then,
I think it was even now.
No, it was the same year. The same year. It was like, I think this happened in May. June, and around July, August. Yeah, in July, August, I turned to Larry and I said, the Salmon Collective want you to go fishing. And he said, well, I'm not that fond of salmon fishing. I've done it in the past. It's not really something that is like very profitable, or it's like, I'm not really into it. That's what you said. Says the Salmon Collective really wants you to go fishing this year, Larry. You have to go. I'll look into it. I'll see if I can get some crew, but it's probably not going to happen. It's very late in the day. Everybody's ready with their own crews and ships. You know, it's like, oh, but okay, I'll look into it. Anyways.
I got a call.
The crew wanted.
A couple of my old crew called up and said, hey, Larry, will you please take us salmon fishing?
Yeah.
And we really want to go.
Okay. All right, so we'll do it then.
Let's go.
Yeah. And then I said to him, listen, the fish that are coming are the ones that are going to die through various reasons in the next few months or weeks. And they're scheduled to die, and they're choosing to die on your ship. In, like, they're jumping in, basically. They're choosing you and your ship because they want to say thank you and they want to become part of your life. For saving gazillions of baby fish, right? Gazillions of babies, and this is they want to do this as a thank you.
That seems a bit strange. I just carried them down the river to go catch them and bonk them on the head.
Yeah.
This isn't compute for me. It didn't really make a lot of sense to me, but I've gotten used to, you know, over time, some of the things that you say.
Yeah.
I can't necessarily ground in, this is like a book I read. Thank you. Oh, the fish tell you when it's time to go. Oh, that's okay. The fish told. Okay, I'm going. Yes,
right.
I mean, it isn't a literal like training experience. Like none of the guys that I'd ever talked to or learned over the years said, what you really need to do is connect with the salmon and find out, you know, X, Y, Z, you know, talk to them. They don't teach you that, but that's actually... But some of the very, very, very best fishermen, I know they must be, because there's literally no explanation for them to go where they're going otherwise. Anyways, I was like, I had it in my head and you told me, but I was still like only half-hearted about it.
Yes.
But when I got guys that called me the next day and said, can you please take us? I'm like, okay, that's as clear as it can be. Mm-hmm. Yes, let's go, guys. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't quite prepared for what I was going to encounter.
No, that was insane, wasn't it?
Well, similarly to the greenie, the rockfish that I would catch with this feng shui CD, where it would be like 60,000 pounds, 2-3 full semi-trucks, much as a fish in 15 minutes. The salmon were the same.
Yeah.
The guys were coming in with 20 and 30 fish.
Yeah.
And we had 1,000.
Yes. I remember that.
And it was the whole year.
Yes. And the example you mentioned very often is like there was one salmon that came up.
Barely hooked on his lip, right? And when you pick him out of the water, it looks like it's impossible that they'll come out of the water because they're just barely hooked. Yeah. But it's a little bit of momentum and I don't know, anti-gravity. They get up and they get into your thingy and then they come right off the hook and they're flapping around. And so this one was like a medium-sized one. He's a nice, healthy fish. He's really beautiful and he's fine. He can go back. I'll throw you back in the water. You go swim up the river or hang out in the ocean, get bigger. I'll catch you next year.
No. What happened?
Well, I tossed him over and he swam right into the open mouth that instant of a giant sea lion.
Yes.
And
it was over.
It was gone. Yeah. And I have to, you know, sea lions are one of the problems when you're catching salmon.
Yes.
Is they'll come around and they eat all the fish off your hooks and they bend your hooks, they break your hooks off and tear everything to pieces because they're a couple thousand pounds or whatever. And the salmon is 10 and they grab it with their mouth and they just rip it. And that bends your hooks off, or they grab the whole salmon and the hook and everything and they rip that off. And then they just bite all the fish up and down.
Yes.
They just make a mess out of it. So there are chances that there was a, well, sea lions don't come up to the back of your boat because fishermen who don't want sea lions to eat their fish make sure that they don't with various mechanisms, including guns and fireworks and all kinds of stuff. So they just don't do it.
Right.
Not any smart sea lion would ever do that.
Right.
And if I had a sea lion literally 5 feet away from my boat while I was doing all this fishing, my hooks would have been gone and the fish would have been bit.
Right.
And there weren't any. Right. And I would have noticed because they go like this. Because they breathe. Yes. Like you could see them. So tossing him in and having him go right into the mouth of a sea lion, freaking impossible. And yet it happened.
Yeah. But I think it was to illustrate to you that the scene was correct. These fish were
already slated.
Already decided to move on to the next fish body. And they chose you.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And I remember, yeah, like you said, like the other ships were bringing in 20 fish and you arrived with 1,000. And it wasn't just one trip.
It was the entire season. Entire season. Yeah. I mean, we even had a 4,000 or 5,000 fish trip.
Yeah.
We stayed out for coho.
Yeah.
And we had 600, 700, 800 every single day for 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is like a real indication to me when you join yourself, you stop saying, here's Larry the fisherman and here's Larry the mystic and the student of spiritual growth, and you join them and it's just Larry, then you can have these type of things happen in your life, right? And you can listen to it and you can move through it and with it and successfully.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lot of people think, well, fishing, you know, it's like it's bloody work. Would a spiritual person do fishing? Because it's so bloody and messy. And then you can see that one and the other don't have, like, they're not necessarily separate, you know?
Right. The same as coder and following energy lines, mystic.
Yeah, mystic and following energy lines.
The same together, right?
Yeah.
And you probably find that true in a lot of things that you until now probably didn't look at from this lens and this set of eyes. If you look at those, like if you look at me who come in with 1,000 fish all summer long and everybody else has 10, and what is it different? And you look in my fish box and you see the hooks I'm using.
The same hooks.
And they're not even especially good. No. They're a little bit rusty. They're a little bit bent. There's not very many of them.
Right.
And all the colors are the same, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
It's not like you have a whole pile of special hooks.
Right.
Right. These are just any hook will do. It didn't even matter.
It didn't matter.
It
didn't.
It had no relevance on the outcome.
Yeah.
Right. Then you know you're looking at someone with some mystical something going on, right?
Yes.
Same with the coder. You find the coder that's like, you give them a thing,
you
find a bug,
you know.
There's a mystic something going on. Yeah. So you can see that in others and you can make that and be that yourself too.
Yes.
Right. That's who's be listening to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we'll those
continue.
Are good stories.
Yeah, we'll continue the conversation.
I'm curious to see what the panel has come up with in their own experiences because, right, We have some very professional.
We did.
A very professional panel.
We did.
Professional in the sense of like corporate professionals.
Right.
Right. Engineers.
Yes.
Corporate America recruiter type. Yes. And
PhD doctor.
PhD doctor education type.
And,
architect. Like, how are they?
And they're all mystics.
Incorporating, and they're all mystics.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they're mystics.
Yes. So
let's see. And let's see what comes up.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
I did want to put in a tiny plug. Some of the stories I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I was watching Flash of Brilliance. Isn't that what it's called?
I don't remember the name.
Yeah, it's a documentary, sort of Sasquatch, but it's more like...
other things.
It's more like what we're talking about.
Expanded
incorporating
awareness.
Your expanded awareness reality. And expanded reality with some Sasquatch research.
Right.
To find that there's more to it than it's like the hairy monkey in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
So y'all...
Yes,
share a link to that too. They're really, really interesting interviews because they're in the embodiment of what we're talking about. People who have moved beyond the singular whatever they are into something bigger.
Yeah, and a lot of these individuals, not all of them, but some of them, I would say, are very much compartmentalizing their Sasquatch interests and research from their professional life or even family life.
Yeah.
Very, very separate one or the other. You can see it a lot in that field. Yes.
So I recommend giving it a look-see.
Okay.
Alrighty. See you at the second hour.
See you soon. Yeah, I remember a story we heard when we went to one of these Sasquatch events.
Yeah.
There's this guy who was a high school teacher, and he was trying to keep his Sasquatch thing secret from the students.
It'll destroy his career.
Yeah, plus, you know, the students won't listen. I think I can't remember what he used to teach, but, you know, they won't listen to him anymore.
It was a hard science.
Yeah, it was like he just didn't want to go there, right? And then somebody found a Facebook post or a Twitter post or something, one of the students, and they say, hey, so you're like, you know, you like Sasquatch or whatever. I can't remember the story how it went, but basically what happened was that he got really strung up about it and tried to defend himself and tell them this and this and the other. And then one kid said,